This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, Helen Farmer with you. Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, if any of these conversations or experts would be useful or meaningful to someone in your life, feel free to share this with them. We are live, of course, on air Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. And on today's episode, marking Baby Loss Awareness Week, running from the 9th to the 15th of October, there are a series of online virtual events, but also some real life meetups too. We were speaking to a number of experts and people who have been through exactly that. Cassie Destino of IVF Support UAE sharing her experiences. Lala Langtree White discussing what exactly people can do to come together and mark the loss of a loved one. And speaking as well to a psychologist, answering some of your questions and hearing your experiences too. And ADHD is something we discuss an awful lot, but mostly it is to do with hyperactive young children who can't sit still. So what about a diagnosis in adulthood? Jenny Mullen was on the air to explain what that diagnosis meant to her, how it's caused her to look back on her life with a completely different lens. And we were speaking to Jolene Palmer, an educational psychologist, about some of the signs that you need to be aware of, whether it's your own behavioural characteristics or someone in your life. And it was Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist, who's joining us for our Psychology Hour. Happy hormones, how to get them, how to boost them. And we're hearing about what makes you happy too.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And it goes without saying that losing a baby leaves a profound sense of loss for mum and dad. And it's incredibly hard to move on, especially when you've prayed hard to get pregnant, stay pregnant. And against the odds, it sadly doesn't work out. So how do parents cope, and if not move on, but move forward after an incredibly sad event such as this? If you have suffered miscarriage or infant loss, it's a safe space to tell your story this afternoon. We will, of course, listen. And if you want to offer any advice to someone who might be going through that, please do feel free to get in touch. I've been chatting with Cassie Destino, who's the founder of IVF Support UAE. She has been through it. Here's her story.
I had a miscarriage after my first IVF. So it was sort of doubly painful because we'd had to go through such a difficult time to even get pregnant in the first place. And it was just at our 12-week scan when we thought we were in the clear. And it was during that scan we saw that there was no heartbeat. And we had to terminate that pregnancy. That was about 10 days before we moved from San Francisco to Abu Dhabi. So it was a very stressful moment in time, having had just gone through an IVF, just had the loss, and then having to, you know, move to the other side of the world. It was very, very difficult for us to deal with because we just weren't sure we were going to be able to get pregnant again. We had had such a hard time getting pregnant that first time, and there was no guarantee that we were going to be successful again. So it was particularly frightening for us. We did end up having two more IVF cycles in Abu Dhabi once we moved. The second one was what they call a chemical pregnancy. So it was a positive pregnancy test, but the pregnancy doesn't progress. That's a loss as well, but we knew right away that that pregnancy wasn't going to progress. Next IVF we did, we had two heartbeats on the scan. And, you know, we were obviously very excited, but it took us a very long time to relax into that. And we were very lucky in that we did end up having twins on that pregnancy.
Cassie, like many people, I'm sure listening today, have been through that sense of loss, going through it. And people around, of course, offering some comfort and support. But here's what she didn't find helpful.
I think it's particularly unhelpful to tell someone, well, at least you can get pregnant. And, you know, your body knows how to get pregnant. That's not very helpful. I don't think it's helpful to say, all you need to do is blank, and then you'll get pregnant again. You know, all you need to do is relax. All you need to do is go on a holiday. All you need to do is stop thinking about it. You know, the fact is, nobody knows what anybody else needs to be successful. And giving advice, although always well-intentioned, is often very unhelpful. And really, the best thing we can do is just say, I see your pain. I understand it. If you have experience with it yourself, I think it's really helpful to share. This happened to me as well. Take away some of the stigma. Take away some of the secrecy, because it is an experience so many women have, and we shouldn't be ashamed of it. So to share your experience is helpful, but to say, you know, I did this and then I got pregnant, that's generally not going to be very helpful.
And as you heard, Cassie now has a happy family, twins, but does she ever think about her first baby?
To be honest, I don't really think about that baby very much. I was very focused on moving on and trying again and trying to be successful again. I put all of my focus in growing my family and not really looking back. Now, that's a very personal decision that I made, and I understand that that is not how a lot of people are. But for me, the way that I needed to keep going was just to keep going and not look back on it and not dwell on it and just think to myself, that wasn't my baby. The ones that I have now, those are my babies. But that first one, that wasn't my baby. And that's how I handled it.
Cassie there sharing what she went through and how ultimately she now has that happy family.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Baby Loss Awareness Week, marking from the 9th to the 15th of this month. And there's a community event currently happening today, right now, to support parents who have suffered a loss. And here's my chat with Lala Langtry-White of Small and Mighty Babies and Love Through Loss. She's also a grief doula. And she told us about what's happening today.
It's about raising awareness, of course, of bringing some education and also connecting parents so that it can feel a less isolating experience and knowing where to access support. This awareness is not for the families who've been through loss. It's for those who haven't, to understand how complex and how devastating this can be. And it's never caveated by a gestation or anything else. We recognize loss right from trying to conceive through to infancy.
And I think it's so, so important to be having these conversations, of course, and I think Awareness Week can be a great time of shining a light across many of the issues that people go through. But it's not just one week, Lala, and I know you do work all year round, which I think it's so important that if there isn't, as you say, people don't feel emotionally ready to have these conversations, to hear these conversations right now, they will be able to be accessed. How do you feel like the conversation around baby loss has changed regionally over the last few years? I know you've been hugely involved for quite some time through Small and Mighty Babies in particular. Are we talking about it more? Is it happening more? What's that dialogue like?
I think we are definitely talking about it more. And and I think what you said is absolutely right. We need to recognise that this is a 24/7 lived experience for families that have been through this. What this week does is really highlight it. It brings this area, this dynamic of parenting and pregnancy and parenthood out of the shadows and really shines a light on them and recognises them for the parents that they are, for the experience, for the loss and the love of their baby that they have. And, you know, last year, the devastating news of Chrissy Teigen and John Legend going through this experience really served to, again, just bring this onto a bigger global platform. But I think, you know, every time I live this every day, so it's very much part of my conversation that I feel very comfortable having, and the families that I support. I host a monthly support group for Love Through Loss, but it amazes me at how much it is still sort of swept under the carpet or kept in the shadows. And that's something that really does a disservice to the families who experience it. So I think we've seen massive improvement in the region, and I think we've got so much more that we can still do collectively.
For me, it's been really eye-opening, for want of a better phrase, to see on social media this week, people who I'm friends with, people who I know perhaps distantly, all marking baby loss Awareness Week in their own way. People who I didn't know had been affected by it, whether, as you say, it might be an early stage miscarriage or through infant loss. And I think that's exactly it. You know, unfortunately, shame and stigma thrives in silence. And I'm so happy that these conversations are happening more and more, and people feel like they can get that community support, that they can have someone who has been through that or someone who has supported people who've been through that, so they can have the conversations that are truly going to help them when they are ready. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about Friday afternoon, because this is one of the most important events in the Love Through Loss calendar. What happens at Al-Barari this coming Friday, Lala?
So Al-Barari is a beautiful, we're always so grateful that they give us that space in the nature escapes for families to come together in remembrance of commemoration of their baby, of their experience of pregnancy, of parenthood, to be able to share stories with one another, to discuss with mental health professionals, perhaps what support might be available to them and how it might benefit them, to take a walk within nature, to take some time for breathing and grounding and just being in that shared environment. I know you've talked recently on social media about how much you wanted to talk about your girls when you were away from them. And again, it's being able to have this experience. You talked about your friends sharing about it. And I think, you know, one of the heartbreaking things is loving a baby that you don't feel able to have part of that conversation, that parenting conversation that those with living children do so naturally every day. And it's a really big chance to come together. It's beautiful. This year it falls on the Friday for the Wave of Light. So we'll be doing that candle lighting at 7 p.m. in Al-Barari. We invite bereaved siblings to come along. So there's enough space for it to make it whatever anyone needs to be. Bring a picnic rug, come and be together as a family and recognize the family member, the baby that perhaps is not with you today. You also have a chance to register on Small and Mighty and in the Love Through Loss for a little star engraved with your baby's name on as well. Or if you didn't name your baby, it can be Spud, Bump, Star, whatever it was that you recognize your baby by.
Lala, I wanted to ask you finally, for anyone who is trying to support someone in their life, whether that's a family member or a friend who suffered a loss of any stage or any kind, how can family and friends support someone who is grieving? An awful people feel like this is out of their depth, and this is your conversation, as you say, every day. You're woken up in the night by doctors, by families who need you to be there by their side to say goodbye and help them deal with that process. But so many of us feel deeply uncomfortable about this because it has lived in silence and sadly some shame for so long. So how can we as friends and families support others if they are going through this?
Allow them to talk as much as they will, as much as they want to. Follow their lead. Ask what you can do to support them, whether it's the basics of helping them care for themselves by help dropping off food, doing a school run if there's older siblings, for example. What can you do practically to help? You know, nothing helpful ever started with the words, at least, you know, you can get pregnant or you can try again. We see this a lot with multiple pregnancies, you know, at least you've got one baby. You know, there is no at least within loss. So watch the sessions, understand and follow parents' lead very much on what they want to do. But most parents just want to be able to talk freely about their baby as you and I do.
I'm going to let you get back to your busy afternoon of education, empathy and a whole lot of connection too. Thank you again.
Thank you for helping us spread the conversation.
That was Lala Langtry-White of the Love Through Loss community.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Baby Loss Awareness Week. It started on the 9th, running through until the 15th. And we've been hearing from many of you on the text line wanting to pay tribute to losses that you've had in your life and also asking questions of our next guest. Dr. Vasiliki is with a psychologist at Thrive Wellbeing Centre. She's part of the centre's maternal mental health team and an expert in infertility as well. Doctor, thank you for being with us today. We've been hearing from a number of people who've been through this themselves and are supporting others. And I just wondered if you were able to shed a bit of light on, you know, what this week sets out to achieve and how it can be helpful to parents who have been through a baby loss.
Thank you so much for having me this evening. So I think this week is so important in increasing awareness and reducing the stigma of perinatal loss. Yeah, we've seen how perinatal loss covers a wide range of loss or a baby loss, yeah, from a miscarriage early on in the pregnancy up to the 24th week of gestation, but then can move on to, we speak of stillbirth from the 24th week onwards till around the birth or during birth. And then with neonatal loss around, or if a loss occurs on the first month of the life of a baby. So very different losses in nature, but at the end, they kind of encompass the same kind of elements of trauma and grief for the couples who've been there.
I think that's exactly right. And from what Lala Langtry-White was saying earlier, she's part of the Love Through Loss community. It's not a competition. Someone who suffers a loss of a month old baby necessarily hasn't suffered a worse grief than someone who'd been trying desperately hard and didn't hear a heartbeat at 10 weeks. And I think it's really important not to diminish anyone's experience, because sometimes it's not about the, you know, the amount of time. It can be about the time that baby's been longed for, or the promise, the, you know, the
process you've been through in order to get there, to get pregnant, of course, or, you know, the expectations, the dreams, the waiting. So there's no comparison of human experience. Yes, such a subjective experience that's going to be so different from one couple to another, from one parent to another, from one person to another. There's no right or wrong way to grieve. There's no grief that is more important or less important than another. And I think maybe that's the message a bit today, one of the messages today, you know. A grief can take so many different forms, and that doesn't change anything in its severity and the gravity or the meaning it can carry for a person and in a person's trajectory.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you, though, a little bit about the different experiences that a mum and a dad might have, and the toll it can take on a relationship. Can you offer any insights there?
Sure. So I think the main difference I would see, and that I've seen in my experience as well, is the difference between the mother experiencing grief in her body. Like, there's a physical sensation of a hollowness, you know, of a void in her body. You know, there's a siege of the body that is being affected, and especially when there's been infertility process leading up to the pregnancy. So the feminine body is heavily involved in a pregnancy, that it goes by itself. But so the father is more symbolically involved. Like, the father is going to embody the intended father is going to experience guilt in a more symbolic manner, when it comes to all those expectations and the projections that he was having about the baby, the dreams that surround having a baby and what fatherhood would mean for him, and transitioning into fatherhood. Whereas for the woman, there's going to be on top of this transitioning into motherhood and the symbolic investment of motherhood and this whole transition, we'll also find a physical experience. You know, we'll see women who've had to give birth and the baby couldn't make it, or we'll see women who needed to have a dilation and curettage after a miscarriage. So their body is always, you know, the center of medical investigations, of medical scrutiny, of medical follow-ups. Like, there's a difference of size.
I'd love to go to the text line now, if you don't mind. Amelia, thank you so much for your message saying, this week we're remembering our baby Carmella. We lost in 2015. I've got a boy and a girl, and I always tell them about their big sister. Even though we never met her, she always has a space in our hearts. She will always be their big sister. Message here saying, I felt an incredible amount of guilt when we lost our little one during my second trimester. I was always stressed, working 12 hours a day. I had a medical history of PCOS, which didn't help. My husband had always been so supportive, but it took a long time before I got over that guilt. And Freya saying, miscarriage is far more common than I thought. As a young woman who wants children, it's now one of my biggest fears. What would you say to anyone who might be afraid to get pregnant because they can't perhaps even begin to fathom the idea of this kind of loss or trauma, or someone who's been through it and desperately wants another baby but is so frightened?
Yeah. No, in fact, miscarriage is very common. The statistics are 1 in 3 pregnancies, or 1 in 4 women will experience miscarriage. So it's more common than we know. It's more of a common feminine experience than we realize. And if it stops someone from trying to get pregnant, have they had a miscarriage before? Or have they never had? Have they never been pregnant? I think it's worthy of a more deeper investigation in what's going on for this person. What I've seen frequently is a story, transgenerational story, of miscarriage in a person's history. Like, if we look at their siblings' line or the mother's, so we could see a miscarriage in the mother of the woman who would try to get pregnant. I don't know if I make sense. Do I make sense?
It does. Thank you.
Yeah. So in the sense that if we, someone who saw, like the lady who's contacting us, being afraid of having a miscarriage and that keeping her from trying to get pregnant, maybe we would see in her story a miscarriage in the previous generations, or the way her family has been marked by miscarriage. And you see this transgenerational impact is affecting her today. So there's something that there that needs to be worked through and accepted, sort of processed, for her to be able to take that step and take that risk. It is a risk. Like, no pregnancy is ever guaranteed to end in a baby in our arms. This is this is a medical fact.
I think for a lot of people, that's the frustration. Sometimes it's just a case of a doctor saying, we don't know why this happened. It's just bad luck. And to not be able to trace back those steps and do things differently the next time,
the guilty, you see our other listener who's mentioning working very hard and maybe having this guilt of having worked too hard or being too stressed. There's been pregnancies in the most adverse environments that were full term, and there's been pregnancies in the most privileged of environments that didn't go full term. You see, there is no rule, and there's nothing can be set in stone. So it's about trying, and it's about being led by a desire to have a baby. I guess at the bottom line, the desire to have a baby is what drives a couple forward in trying again.
I've got a really interesting question here, and one I hope you can help with, saying, again, no name, and it's absolutely fine. Just want to make sure you get the answers and hopefully the reassurances that you need on the show this afternoon. It's 4001. Anonymous message saying, I'm due to start a new job next week, and I'm dreading the children question coming up in conversation with my new colleagues. In my last workplace, everyone knew what I'd been through, so I never had to face that question. Does your expert have any advice on how to respond to the dreaded question? We have tried and failed to have children so many times. So I can imagine going into a new work environment and had previously been in a place where everyone knew your story, they knew your struggles, and you didn't need to have to dredge up those feelings or face having to say words that you don't want to say. If someone asks a question that you deem too upsetting or too personal, any advice here?
Well, I would reflect exactly that thank you very much for asking, but this is a very personal question. I would rather not answer. Or this is a very personal matter. How many children do you have? You see, I would revert. Maybe there's a... I coach often my patients into reverting questions, sort of sending them back, sort of reflecting back to the person asking the question and reversing it, you see? Like, how does it feel if I ask you that?
And I think that's exactly right. You don't have to, you're not indebted to answer anything
to
anyone.
You don't have to answer anything. And having children or not having children, having been through a journey of your own is one's prerogative. And no one can judge. There are individuals who will judge. But at the end of the day, a couple's journey or a person's journey is their own journey and belongs to them. So if they feel like sharing parts of it or all of it, that is absolutely fine. But if they feel like keeping it to themselves, this should be a right that should be protected.
Dr.
That can be protected, that a person who needs to, I think that our listener can stand up and say that I don't feel comfortable discussing this right now. I'd like to focus on my work and on my new role.
And all the best in that new role.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Baby Loss Awareness Week, and I'm joined now by Dr. Vasiliki, psychologist at Thrive Wellbeing Centre. She's part of the centre's maternal mental health team and an expert in infertility as well. We've had a number of messages, doctor, asking how to support a friend or family member who has suffered a loss, and people being very non-specific, but as we are talking about Baby Loss Awareness Week in its entirety, it can be from an early stage miscarriage all the way through to the loss of a child. How best, and there's never going to be a one-size-fits-all answer for this, but anything that is particularly helpful for someone that you're trying to support through a loss?
I think it's so important to just be there, to be there for the person who's suffering such a loss, to show up. Show up, be there as much as you need, be empathetic. So to show empathy, to show that you're present, to show that you can listen. And no judgment, no applying any rush or not having, the friend hurry up in their grieving process and wrapping it up and moving on, like not sort of applying any pressure on them going out again and smile again, being happy again. Sort of to wait for the process to unfold and to be there, sit by them and to receive the pain, sort of share the pain. You need to feel the pain because it's a pain so particular that those who have been through it can only have the sense, or us who study it can have a sense of what it really involves. But as a friend who hasn't been there, you can sit by the person and try to empathize as much as you can, and allow them to express whenever they feel like it and whenever they want to get into the feelings and the words of what it has been like for them, to be in that sharing moment.
I think that's such an interesting perspective, to be honest, because we're used to talking about those stages of grief, and it's not that easy. It's not that prescriptive. Some people, we heard from Cassie earlier, who, you know, was desperate to have children, and when she had that miscarriage, just thought, right, I've got a plan. I'm going to continue with the IVF. We're going to have, you know, our eyes on that goal. Other people, of course, choosing to acknowledge that life lost. And I just wondered, if people do want to keep that baby's memory alive, are there any ways that you've had with clients that people have found particularly comforting in the past?
I think sort of commemorating the date a loss has happened, or the date a loss was acknowledged, has been helpful for a lot of couples. And having a ritual, a family ritual or a couple's ritual around that day. Or it can be a photo album of the scans, or of, you know, it depends, of course, on the loss. Yeah, here we really need to take this case by case. But whatever is going to be meaningful in helping the couple make sense out of what happened, acknowledge what happened, so recognizing what happened and not being in denial of what happened, can only allow a person to accept and move on. So we cannot accept a reality if we deny the reality. Mm-hmm. See, we need to first overcome the denial and the shock of the initial period, and then accept, and then be able to grieve and move on.
I think also, you know, in your role there at Thrive, really is so important, because when someone has been through the loss, they might be trying to protect the feelings of their partner. They might not want to upset someone in their life by talking about it. And by having someone who is neutral and who has no agenda and who has experience and understands that there are so many people who have been through this, it's so, so valuable. So I really would urge anyone out there, male, female, of any age, to talk through this with someone that they know and trust. And for some lucky people, that might be a friend. For some others, it might be a professional. But please know that you are so far from alone. As you said, Dr. Lee, this is a much more common shared experience than perhaps we even realise.
Yes.
And you guys at Thrive,
and being able
for that.
To share. So I think sharing with a professional that's and sort of processing it in a professional setting is one. And we were discussing earlier how a couple can cope, but how this can be, how such a loss can take a toll on a couple. Yeah, because of the experience is so different from one person to another, from one woman to a man, but also from one woman to another woman, for that matter. So because the experience is going to be so subjective, then there's no right or wrong way to mourn and to grieve, then only time can help unfold what it really meant for each person, and only time can help process what happened and make sense of what happened, and for a person to be able to park this in as a part of their history, and to accept that that was part of the history that was written, and that now we'll move on to create a new history, or to create, you know, new memories. Sometimes therapy can help unblock all that.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time today. You can be
found
at Thrive there. Thank you. And thank you to everyone who got in touch to share experiences, to pay tribute to losses, and to share what you have been through.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And we've discussed attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, numerous times on the show before, but these conversations have always been around children. But according to CDC, the Center of Disease Control and Prevention in the US, it's one of the most common neurodevelopment disorders of childhood, usually diagnosed amongst young people, often lasts into adulthood. And children in particular might have trouble paying attention, controlling impulsive behaviours, or being overly active. But what about grown-ups? Being diagnosed as an adult has its own challenges. And for many people, it does answer the questions that they've had all through the years. We're now joined by Jenny Mullen. She comes on the show from Which School Advisor. She's a Dubai mum who's been recently had exactly that diagnosis of ADHD as an adult, and says it has opened as many wounds as it has healed. She normally discusses schools, as I said, but today telling her story. Jenny, thank you so much for being with us today. And I know you've got a bit of a different hat on. We're normally talking about school news and guidelines and regulations, and it's all about you this afternoon. I really, really appreciate your honesty, because This has been coming up again and again and again, and I'm just curious to hear your story. why did you start having questions and what led to your diagnosis? Can you tell us what happened?
I think, for me, it was as simple as reading a magazine article and feeling like someone had written it about me. It was like a checklist of my life. So that's how it started. It was as simple as that.
So reading this article and presumably just nodding along with every point, what were some of the sentences, the phrases, the descriptions of characteristics or behaviours that were really resonating, Jenny?
Yeah, and I think part of this whole process of me understanding what ADHD really is has opened up to me the fact that for many people with ADHD, that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, they are actually not the key aspects of this disorder that affect me. It's a spectrum, it's a range of all sorts of things. But reading this article, for me, what stood out first of all was memory. My memory is, you know, my kids call me the goldfish, you know, it's just it's absolutely awful, my memory. And that's, you know, short-term memory, you know, I'm classic walk into rooms, what am I looking for, what am I doing in here, you know, that kind of thing all the time. I always remember my husband laughing at me when we first met and I was booking something over the telephone and I gave the issue number of my debit card as issue number 22. And he was like, who on earth gets to number 22 of the same card? But also my long-term memory in terms of, I really don't have many childhood, I don't really remember my childhood at all. And when I do play back memories, I don't have sort of video recall of memories. I can't play a scene in my head, if you like. It's all images and separate sounds.
So was there anything in your childhood or even kind of younger years that would have suggested a diagnosis at all? Anything a teacher might have said or a parent that could have flagged and perhaps saved you years of trying to understand why you felt so-called disorganized or scattered or loss of, you know, or lack of memory?
I think the thing is, possibly these days it would have been noticed because we do understand ADHD a lot better. For me, I was academic. I was a prefect at school. You know, I wasn't misbehaving. I was a good kid who followed the rules and you know, did what I was told to do. But actually, I never lived up to the academic potential that I was always told that I had. My exam results were always off. I went to college, I dropped out, I tried another course. When I got to university, I dropped out of university and then tried another course. You know, there was a cycle, I think, that could have been stopped had I have understood better how my brain worked, for sure. But, you know, it was the 90s. I think, you know, ADHD then was hyperactive little boys.
Mm-hmm. That's my answer to a lot of things. It was the 90s. Jenny Mullins with us this afternoon.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And this afternoon, we are marking ADHD as adults because it has its own challenges. But for many people, it also answers a lot of questions they've had for many, many years. And a diagnosis can be the start of a brand new chapter. If you can relate, if you're an adult with ADHD, if you've got any questions, educational psychologist Jolene Palmer joining us just after 3:30. Jenny Mullen joining us is on the line now. She's a Dubai mum who recently had a diagnosis. In her words, says this has opened as many wounds as it has healed. And I wonder, Jenny, if you could just tell us and kind of demystify a little bit about what happens on the other side of diagnosis. Because I think for many people, that's the mystery. You know, you have this label, but then what do you do with it? What kind of plan has been put in place for you?
I mean, first of all, it's as much, I think, a grieving process as it is a happy moment when you're diagnosed, because there's this intense sense of relief that where you feel like, you know, thank goodness I finally know what all of these things were and will continue to be. But then there's also this sort of, oh, if only I'd known, if only I'd known when I was 15, if only I'd known when I was 25, you know. So it's, diagnosis is not an end point, for sure. For me, I am now taking medication. The traditional treatment for ADHD is a stimulant-based medication, which I know can be quite scary for some people, and they are, you know, controlled drugs here in the UAE. It takes some time to get I've lost my train of thought. There's a good
dose,
example.
Combination, dosage,
the right, yeah,
medication,
the right
cocktail.
Yes. The right dosage, it's clearly it's wearing off now. The right dosage, the right brand of medication, you know, but I think I'm getting there now. But it's been several months of trying different things, trying different combinations. But when it does work, I have this overwhelming feeling of like, wow, is this what everybody else's brain is like? I had no idea.
So can you describe that to us, the difference that you've experienced because of the treatment?
I'm able to do one thing at a time. That's, you know, the number one thing. I am constantly otherwise doing two things at once. In fact, in the break, I don't know if I'm still moving, but your producer said you're kind of moving around too much. You need to sit still because it's making a noise.
Like, ironically, that's what we're talking about this afternoon.
So yeah, constantly doing two things at once and, you know, take the medication and I can just start something and you know, move through the day and finish it. Whereas before it would probably the end result that anybody external to me would see would be a finished product at the end of the day. However, what had gone on in the day would have been doing a bit of this and then doing a bit of that and then starting this and then remembering that I had to do that. And it, you know, the sort of internal stress that would have caused me might not have been apparent to other people, but for me, it would have been really difficult. So that's the number one thing. But then there's other very strange things. When I read now, if I've taken the medication, the voice that narrates the book I'm reading is louder. Which sounds bonkers. And the first time, and it doesn't happen to everybody. I think everybody reacts to these things a bit differently. But the first time it happened to me, I mean, I had to put the book down because it was such a strange experience. But again, I think it sort of speaks to the difficulties that people with ADHD have in terms of retaining written information, because it just has greater clarity when I've taken the medication.
That is absolutely fascinating. It really is. And, you know, we've talked in the past about ADHD running in families. And I wonder that as a mother, is this perhaps aided you in viewing your children's behaviours differently? Any thoughts about getting them assessed? Any flags?
Well, do you know, the first person who I myself diagnosed is my mom.
Really?
Oh, for 100%. Yeah. And I mean, I think she's of an age now where I don't think she would pursue a diagnosis. But, you know, now I've shared lots of different information with her. She's like, oh, wow. You know, so 100% I see it in my family. And certainly I'm going to have both of my boys. I've got two young boys, 7 and 11. I'm going to have them assessed for it. One, I suspect, more than the other. But knowing how it could have helped me, just knowing, I'll get them assessed. And if it turns out they haven't got it, then great. Mm-hmm. But if we know, then we can help, you know.
I think that is really wise of you. And I think it's really brave of you to be pursuing a diagnosis in adulthood. And to, honestly, through a conversation like this, and I truly believe that people listening will be going, I too have felt scattered and lack of focus and disorganized and blamed myself for decades. And I'm so pleased that it's all coming together. And I'm not saying it's a quick fix or a cure-all, but, you know, certainly information can lead to power and change. And I'm thrilled for you, Jenny. I really am. So thank you for sharing your story with us this afternoon. For anyone who would be perhaps reluctant to get a diagnosis, having heard what you've shared this afternoon, what would you say?
You know, do it. I mean, it's to me, you know, ADHD is not just about the challenges. You know, people with ADHD, we're creative, we're innovative, we come up with loads of ideas. I am the woman you want in a crisis. You know, that's when my brain goes quiet, when everybody else is is losing their minds. Mine is completely cool as a cucumber. So there's loads of strengths to having ADHD. It's nothing to be ashamed of. There's treatment to help you out there. And knowing helps you to forgive yourselves for some of the things that perhaps you haven't done well or wondered why you haven't achieved in your life.
Jenny, thank you so much again. Really, really appreciate your honesty. And I know this conversation can help an awful lot of people.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're continuing our discussion around an adult being diagnosed with ADHD, following on from Jenny Mullen there sharing her experience. And joining us on the line is Jolene Palmer. She's an educational psychologist at Insight Psychology to share her thoughts around diagnosis and even what treatment can look like. And I think there's still a huge amount of confusion around this. You know, many people have, of course, heard of ADHD. And it makes us think about children who can't pay attention in the classroom or hyperactive, impulsive. but adults can, as we've been hearing, have it too. In the US, about 4-5% of US adults have it, but few adults get diagnosed or indeed get the treatment that they need. Shalene, thank you so much for being with us today to offer a bit of clarity and perhaps some reassurances to anyone that this might be, you know, raising eyebrows or even red flags for. I mentioned there that stat out of the States, 4-5% of adults having ADHD. Do we know anything about regional numbers? What's your experience?
Helen, thank you so much for having me on. In terms of regional numbers of the prevalence of ADHD in adults, I don't have any specifics. You know, I do know, say, for example, in terms of men are diagnosed twice as much as females would be in terms of ADHD. But to give you a specific number in terms of regional numbers, unfortunately, I don't have that.
When it comes to people that are coming through your doors at Insight, then what do we know about that kind of gender split or even the age that adults are being diagnosed regionally that you're seeing?
I think in terms of the people that come through our doors and adults that are querying whether or not they have ADHD, believe it or not, it's because we were able to identify their kids have ADHD.
Really?
And sometimes, yeah, and it's quite, you know, when we talk with adults and we say, well, this is why your child meets criteria for ADHD, and we kind of go through a symptom list and we kind of explain it. You have the parent sitting like, oh my goodness, you've just explained my husband, or the husband will say, you've just explained my wife or myself.
Wow.
You know, and they're able to identify it in terms of, you know, just kind of like identifying the same difficulties that they see in their kids that they had when they were their age.
That is so, so interesting. And I'm sure for many adults, getting that diagnosis must be like, you know, jigsaw pieces fitting together, suddenly having an explanation for things that they might have struggled with or identified over the years. It must be a huge source of relief to lots of people.
Oh, definitely. You know, even sometimes for kids that we diagnose and we explain it to them, the relief that they see, that we see in them, but especially for adults. You know, it's almost like you can see the change in their facial expressions, and they would often look at you and it's like, so many things make sense now, you know. And then they just start telling us about their experiences as a child, and it just kind of resonates with them in terms of, this explains just so much more, you know. And yes, definitely a sense of relief.
And, you know, as we know, it's very hard to kind of pigeonhole a lot of the symptoms. You know, they can range from mild to severe and can obviously change over time depending on life experiences. But they can cause, you know, problems in all sorts of different parts of life, you know, at home, at work, in relationships or at school. Can you explain a little bit about some of the things to be aware of when you're identifying ADHD in adults? It's something that people might struggle to do. Do you have a checklist of sorts, Gillian?
Definitely, you know, in terms of what we see a lot of adults with ADHD is a lot of things sometimes is the executive functioning skills, you know, the organization, being able to meet deadlines on time, being able to prioritize things. A lot of the time people who come to us and say, oh, I suffer from severe anxiety. And when we kind of do a bit of the CBT and we kind of investigate a bit more and we backtrack, you know, then a lot of things come to light in terms of, you know, not being able to meet deadlines or always leaving everything to the last, you know, the last minute. And that creates a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that come to us and say, I think I suffer from depression or really low self-confidence. A lot of negative self-talk are sometimes a lot of the red flags that adults would come to us, but actually we're able to identify that there's a history of some ADHD patterns that would come from that. You know, a lot of the, we will have moms come to us, you know, and they'll say, my kid's always telling me, why can't I be like that mom? You know, that kid's mom's never late, or why are you always late picking me up? You know, things are scattered, always losing your keys, misplacing your cell phone, things like that, you know, which sometimes it happens so frequently that it's not a big deal because it's your everyday life. Mm-hmm. But to the point that it actually sometimes has a really big impact on your mental health.
And an impact on mental health that can presumably present in lots of different ways. And that could be these kind of limiting beliefs that, you know, I'm terrible at being organized, or I'm not motivated, or I'm impulsive or angry, which presumably then creates something of a downward spiral and doesn't improve the overall picture at all.
Definitely. It creates a horrible downward spiral. And sometimes, you know, adults with ADHD who have that negative self-talk, it stems from being children that were undiagnosed, mm-hmm. because you'll always, they were always being told, oh, why can't you do this? Why do you always have to do that? Or I've told you 20 times, why don't you listen? Sometimes this is the child, you know, that someone would say, he's so smart, but he's lazy. And actually that poor child is giving 200%, mm-hmm. you know, of their effort, but the output doesn't match the input. So it stems, sometimes it's, you know, it stems from hearing a lot of negative self-talk. And eventually when you're an adult, it's just you continue that negative self-talk for yourself. You know, oh, I'm always late. I'm always so unorganized. My house is never clean. You know, the dinner is never ready. Failed relationships, going from one job to another job, things like that. You know, and when you sit down and you look at all the different aspects of it, you see all the little bits of ADHD trickling through that we'd be able to identify.
I think for lots of people, there is that relief and release in a diagnosis and having a plan, you know, having a label, for want of a better word, because you're able to get the support you need. There might be a community of people around you that you can share your experiences with. But for others, getting a diagnosis can feel quite scary because it means the unknown. It might mean treatment or medication or even fear of judgment. What would you say to anyone who is listening to this going, this is making a lot of sense, but I'm not sure I want to find out?
I think in terms of, there is unfortunately still a negative stigma towards having a label. You know, and what we would try to tell people is that it's not about the label itself, but it's taking ownership and understanding. And once there's that understanding of why things happen the way or the way that they do, or why they did happen, or you're able to identify and resonate with something, one, it gives you peace of mind. The relief is there, you know, and it's sometimes just, it's, if you go and get yourself diagnosed, if you're able to say, like, oh my goodness, I think I have ADHD, it's for your own peace of mind. It's not something that you have to go and announce to the world, mm-hmm. but sometimes it kind of just helps you refocus, reground yourself. When things make sense, we get a better hold on it and we start understanding it a lot more. And there's nothing more empowering than understanding yourself. And that's what I would say. That's the most important thing. Like, if you feel like you've done so many things, but nothing works, mm-hmm. or I've always done this and, you know, I've always been late, or I've always done this and I've given up on that. It's kind of saying that, you know, it does not always have to be like that. You know, understanding helps you make a plan. Understanding and coming to terms with a specific diagnosis in terms of ADHD or executive functioning difficulties that go with that, it's just, it's empowering. It really is. It's liberating and it's empowering.
Can I ask you, Jolene, from your point of view as an educational psychologist at Insights, can you demystify a little bit about what a diagnosis actually involves? You know, what a doctor or an expert such as yourself might do or ask in order to get to that point?
Basically, you know, it's very different for children if we were going to go down the route of assessment and diagnosis for them, mm-hmm. as what it would be for adults. You know, so children, we have to go through the whole process of the educational psychology assessment as psychologists. There are other ways, like I'm not a psychiatrist. You know, I've got a medical doctor where they obviously they have different ways and different tools, and they don't have to do the entire cognitive testing, school interview, peer interview, and parent interview like we have to do. For adults, it is, I would say, a lot different. And sometimes if we do get adults that come in and kind of query whether or not they themselves have ADHD, sometimes I would refer them to either one of my colleagues that focuses more in terms of diagnosing adults, or we put them in touch with a psychiatrist. Because at the end of the day, psychiatrists say, for example, if they do think they want to go down the route of taking medication, mm-hmm. to help with their attention and focus, a psychiatrist would be the person that would prescribe that for them and explain why it can be beneficial and how that medication works. Often what we do find is a psychiatrist would prescribe the medication or do the diagnosis, but refer back to us as psychologists for therapy and intervention in terms of CBT, how to rebuild that self-confidence, how to challenge those negative thoughts that you've built up about yourself, and most importantly, to help building up to have more a solid foundation for your executive functioning skills.
Jolene Palmer in conversation with us. She's an educational psychologist at Insight Psychology.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're discussing ADHD diagnosis in adults and speaking earlier to Jenny Mullen, who described her diagnosis as opening as many wounds as it healed. And speaking now to Jolene Palmer, she's an educational psychologist at Insight Psychology. And once you've got that diagnosis, how do you move forward? CBT is something that gets mentioned a lot, but what exactly is it?
CBT would be your cognitive behavior therapy, you know, your behavioral therapy. And it's all about understanding that, you know, we don't have control over situations and people, but we do have control over how we respond or how we feel about things. And most importantly, you know, our mind is a brilliant thing, but it can also be the darkest place on earth for us. And it's understanding that and being able to challenge negative thoughts. There has to be a balance. And for us as humans, it's so easy to be negative. Even if you have, say, for, you know, negative thoughts come so easily, especially towards ourselves. And CBT is about, okay, how are you going to challenge that thought? You know, how are you going to counteract that thought with a positive one about yourself, for yourself? You know, and that's really hard for people sometimes. And people, adults with ADHD has probably had a whole history of only negativity and hearing negative things, how they're always late, why they never do anything right, or, you know, always having to try harder. And then it's kind of taking a step back and challenging those thoughts and say, but you know what? Look how amazingly far I've come in life, regardless of this diagnosis. It's been hard. It's been tricky. But wow, I've been able to keep it together, you know, with where other people don't have this diagnosis and they've been able to do it. So it's all about challenging those negative thoughts and replacing it with positive ones. You know, it's basically the foundations of, you know what they say, you are the energy that you attract.
Yes.
So it's making sure that you put out that positive energy, not about everything, but about yourself and what you want for yourself.
Can I ask you as well, Jolene, lastly, are there any things that adults with ADHD can do, lifestyle changes or purely practical things? Maybe it's to do with a home environment, you know, people that you do surround yourself with that can really help improve that self-esteem, but also the day-to-day challenges that people might be facing. You know, could decluttering help, for example, or burning off extra energy? I don't know. I'm curious.
Definitely, you know, exercise, I would say first thing, get a hobby or exercise, you know, that routine. Establish a routine. And for people with ADHD, it's hard, but, it, you know, just get in the swing of it. Because once you have a routine, it helps you manage things and you kind of, once it kind of, you know, what I need to get ready for when I need to get it ready helps. A simple thing like make sure you have your clothes ready for the next day. Mm-hmm. You know, little things like that. Often what we would say is cut out certain foods. It doesn't always work, even for kids, but sometimes it does. You know, like your sugars, you know, your junk food. Obviously, sometimes for adults, what we do know when it goes undiagnosed and it has some other mental health complications, there's some substance abuse, drinking, smoking. And if you're around people that just absolutely thrive in that environment, it's not good for you. So I would say, obviously, try to avoid, you know, things like that in which you find yourself in a situation that you don't have control over when it comes to substances. Little steps like that, seek help. You know, it's okay when you tell people, oh, I'm very scatterbrained. You know, I always forget things. But that's one of the things that you're saying, okay, I'm identifying this with myself. I need help. And just kind of starting with little things like that, getting yourself in a routine. Make sure you get a hobby that you like. Get rid of some energy. Exercise is always good. I mean, in general, we just feel good after a good, you know, a good exercise. It helps with clearing out your mind, putting things in perspective. And at the end of the day, you know, if you still need help, go see someone that can help you with your executive functioning skills, that can help you. A lot of people and adults with ADHD often have life coaches, you know, which is great. It helps them with that. A lot of other adults do seek medication and they would swear by it, which is great. It's all about personal life. life changes.
I think that's exactly right. There's never going to be a one size fits all, whether it is certain symptoms or characteristics that show, whether it is severity. If you've met one person with ADHD, you've met one person with ADHD. It doesn't necessarily mean that one exactly. thing's going to work for another. So it's really, really important if this conversation has made somebody think, whether it's about themselves or someone in their life, that there are people out there such as yourself and the team at Insights that are on hand to offer some reassurances and to put a plan in place and simply get the conversation started. So, Julian, I can't thank you enough for your time and your own insights this afternoon. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Helen.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is our psychology hour, and earlier this week, we marked World Mental Health Day. So between now and 5 o'clock, we're exploring the ways to get a natural high, making ourselves happy using the chemicals in our body and our brain to make us smile. So what makes you smile? How do you get those happy hormones flowing? It might help someone else out there. Dr. Thuraya joining us live on the line to explore this and offer up some ways we can boost those happy hormones. Dr. Thuraya, how are you?
I'm well, Helen. How are you?
I am, in all honesty, a little bit tired. I could lie, but I flew back early yesterday morning and came back to an overwhelming number of emails. One friend just said, just delete them all, just delete all 900, and if it's urgent, they'll message you again. I was like, that's a really interesting strategy that makes me feel slightly nauseous.
Well, congratulations. What you did is amazing.
Thank you so much. Honestly, I look at the photo of me summiting Kilimanjaro and it honestly feels like someone else did it a million years ago. It's a very, very odd sensation indeed. But speaking of happy hormones, you could not, even more than usual, shut me up. I was flying high for about 24 hours, even after climbing for 18 hours. Body was exhausted, but my brain was buzzing. And I don't know what it was, if it was adrenaline, I have no idea. But I just kept smiling over the next couple of days. Just, yeah, it was incredible. It really, really was. So I'd love everyone to message in today and let them know. And I'm not talking about scaling mountains, but something that makes you happy. It can be something small. It can be something big. It can be silly. It can be serious. Something you weave into your daily routine or something that you save for a treat when you really need either cheering up or just to kind of turn your day around. Let us know. Dr. Thuraya, can you explain, we talk about happy hormones, what are the names, and can you explain a little bit about what they do and how they're released in the body? Let's start with dopamine. What is it and how does your body make it?
Sure. So dopamine is usually called the feel-good or pleasure neurotransmitter, and it plays a role in regulation of motivation, any kind of reward-driven behavior, attention, memory, cognition, mood, sleep. I mean, there's a lot that dopamine does. It's really a mood-boosting neurotransmitter that's released after you reach or achieve a goal. So dopamine is actually created in the body, and it's created in the mind, in the brain. And there are certain things that help its increase, and there are certain things that will decrease it, but there are some things that we can naturally do, and then other times there are things that we can do medically, so giving certain medications that could help with the release of dopamine. So dopamine is the one that a lot of people usually hear about because it's quite connected to addictions in general. Mm-hmm. So there's that dopamine release that usually people are kind of looking for and craving. So dopamine is really well known when it comes to addiction.
Is it this one that you might have if you have some dark chocolate? I can get the dopamine going as much as some other substances.
Well, yes, that is true. I mean, more often than not, what we find is, especially with chocolate, dark chocolate, though, it usually stimulates the release of endorphins, that dopamine and serotonin. So it's a little bit of a lot of things. So when you have some dark chocolate, it's always good to say to yourself, I'm doing well for my mental health.
Looking after my body and my brain today.
Exactly.
So that's dopamine. We've also got endorphins, serotonin, and oxytocin to talk about as well. You already mentioned endorphins, and these can really help with stress and even reduce feelings of pain. Is that right? Or our perception of pain. How does that work?
So it's very interesting because the origin of the word endorphins comes from endogenous, which means coming from the body, and morphine, which is the opiate pain reliever, right? So endorphins are neurotransmitters and hormones that relieve pain, they reduce stress, and they actually induce a sense of well-being. So they're really involved in our natural kind of reward circuits, and they're very much related to important activities like eating, drinking, physical fitness. Mm-hmm. Actually, endorphins, interestingly enough, surge during pregnancy. So endorphins are most commonly associated with exercise, which is where you kind of had that high that you said when you were on Mount Kilimanjaro. I mean, this is usually, endorphins contribute to the runner's high that people talk about as well, which kind of varies from person to person. But in general, like high intensity workouts produce more endorphins than any kind of moderate exercise does.
And it's honestly taken me a long time to realize, and I'm not happy about this, but when I want to exercise the least, when my brain is like, nah, take the trainers off, you cannot be bothered, that generally tends to be when I need to exercise the most and when mm-hmm. you kind of get mm-hmm. kind of really, really do feel the benefit. If you can get, it's very rare that I can actually push past that feeling though, to be honest, Dr. Thrive.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So what makes you smile? Loads of you getting in touch with some brilliant suggestions. So hopefully it can help someone's day turn around if you're having a bit of a day. Some brilliant ideas coming in on 4001. Clinical psychologist Dr. Thrive joining us from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Talk about ways of boosting those hormones in our bodies and our brains. Tim saying, it sounds cheesy, but when I really need a pickup, hugging one or both of my children really does the trick. He says, well done on climbing Killy. Did it in 2003. Good for you, Tim. And that, I think that hug is a really interesting point, Thrive, because I said to the guys at the beginning of the trip, I hug my kids all the time and it really makes me feel better. So I did warn people and say, I physically need hugging on quite a regular basis just to help me kind of cope with life. And I was like, it's going to be a 20-second hug and you're going to have to deal with it. What does that kind of physical touch and hugging in particular do in our bodies? And is this just complete placebo or does it actually have an impact?
Actually, there's a lot of research that goes around the hormone and neurotransmitter of oxytocin. And oxytocin is actually released. It's usually called the cuddle hormone because it's quite released when people or pets snuggle or they bond socially. So, and I mean, other than hugging usually creates like this feeling of like warmth and connection and calmness and relaxation. But oxytocin in general plays a major role in like psychological stability, you know, feelings of relaxation and even trust. Mm. So there's quite a big connection between oxytocin and like bonding with other people or with pets. And this can really reduce your blood pressure. It can slow your heart rate. It can even improve your mood. So at times when a person is feeling anxious, one of the best things to do is hug them.
Unless they hate being hugged and they kind of stand right, there of frozen course. Like a board going, get your arms off right. me. But that's interesting in terms of, as you say, kind of team bonding, a good hug. If everyone's vaccinated, then that's oxytocin. What about serotonin? This is something that we see when it comes to medications as well. If we're looking at treating mm-hmm. Anxiety and depression, what is serotonin and why do you think it can be so effective when it's part of treatment?
Well, serotonin is actually sometimes called the happy chemical, and I'm not a big fan of that word because obviously it implies that people will feel happy if they take any kind of medication mm-hmm. that has serotonin, but that's not really the case. But it is a neurotransmitter, and some people consider it a hormone, but not everyone. But it plays a very big role in stabilizing your mood, feelings of well-being. It also helps like regulate your appetite, your sleep, your digestion, and things like that. But some of the messages that came in before, they were talking about food. Yes. The most interesting thing about serotonin is that about 80 to 90% of it is actually created in the gut.
Ooh, we've talked before about yes. happy gut and, you know, being good for your mental health, that gut-mind connection.
Absolutely.
So there's some good science in this.
Yes, there's a lot of science that talks about the mind and gut connection. And the food that's help your gut microbiome is so important for the production of serotonin, which is essentially your hormone that helps stabilize the way that you feel, as well as even the things that are so important in terms of mood, which is your appetite, your sleep, and your digestion. And there are a lot of foods that can actually contribute significantly to boost serotonin within your body.
So what should we be ordering from a menu or cooking at home to get that good, you know, good gut to healthy mind connection. What should be on our shopping list, Soraya?
Well, there's quite a bit, but the essential ones would be things like apples, berries, beetroot, potato, sometimes like shredded potato, cold potato instead of like boiled or mashed, garlic, pasta, wheat, rye, onions, mushrooms, any kind of legumes, citrus are really good. But also you can add more foods that naturally contain tryptophan. And that's the essential kind of amino acid that the body uses to produce serotonin. So those are things like sunflower seeds, soybeans, oats, quinoa, potatoes, milk, cheese, chickpeas, eggs, like beef or chicken and turkey, cod, salmon, all of those kind of things. Those are quite a lot.
I'm not going to lie. I stopped listening when you said pasta and I was like, well, that's fine then. I'm very happy indeed.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking about boosting your happy hormones, serotonin, dopamine, oxytocin, and the famously happy hormones that promote those positive feelings like pleasure, happiness, even love. Hormones and neurotransmitters are involved in lots of essential processes in the body, heart rate, digestion, but also your mood and your feelings. They're the body's chemical messengers. Some of them are known to help people bond, feel joy and experience pleasure. So I want to know from you, what makes you feel better? What makes you smile? It could be something serious, something big that you've incorporated into your life. It could be little daily habits that just make your heart happy, bring a smile to your face every single day. And lovely to hear some of your messages. And we're reading them out and asking Dr. Soraya, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, if there's any science in your smiles. Dr. Soraya, Yusuf has been in touch saying meditation grounds me, and when I'm grounded, I'm at peace. Meditation is something I would love to be able to do more of, but I've got that monkey mind. With Yusuf, any science in that claim? What do you know about meditation and impact on kind of overall well-being and happiness in the body?
Actually, any kind of relaxing exercise like meditation, yoga, painting, anything like that, a lot of studies have shown long-term benefits in releasing oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, as well as endorphins. So there's a lot of research that supports what he's saying.
Sarah saying swimming makes me the happiest person, coming back to the endorphins around exercise as well. But I guess doing anything that you love, getting into that state of flow and just sometimes mindfulness, sometimes mindlessness. Lubna, woman after my own heart, saying a cup of tea in my garden. Lubna, every single morning I have a smoothie and I sit in the garden and I do my word puzzle. Just, you know, keep the dementia at bay. But there's, you know, it's just something that honestly it does. I do my little anagrams every single morning.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but I need that. I need to have that little just 5 minutes before the school run when the kids are just kind of finishing up, getting their bags together, and then I feel like myself again. Lorraine saying flea markets. I love this. That sense of discovery. Ooh. I love it. I think that's a fab one. Loads of you getting in touch with yours. 4001. You can use that ARN Play app as well. Nesma saying, here are my kids laughing together, my cat purring, nature and being out in the open. What impact does nature have on that kind of rest and digest that, you know, some of the release of the happy hormones? What do you know about being out in the world, Dr. Soraya?
Well, actually, you know, research will show that sunlight exposure for 5 to 15 minutes a day can increase dopamine levels in all individuals. So it's actually really important to go outdoors. And you don't have to be outdoors in terms of like sun tanning and things like that, but just being in the sun to 5 to 15 minutes a day can do wonders for dopamine. And in general, exercising outdoors is really helpful, especially for your breathing. It helps boost, you know, all of the hormones that we've been talking about today.
Alison saying on 4001, buying myself a little treat, new socks, a candle, hair conditioner treatment and hugs. See, always comes back to hugs. Mm-hmm. I'm with you on the socks as well, Alison. Malcolm, interestingly, saying solitude, silence, lack of responsibility and being outdoors. Lack of responsibility, I 100%.
So basically not adulting.
Exactly, but I can see the rest of Dubai nodding along. That idea of just not having that awful to-do list hanging over you, someone cancelling plans that you didn't want to do. Malcolm, thank you for your honesty. Silence and lack of responsibility. I think a lot of people would agree with you. on that. So, Dr. Thuraya, tell us a little bit more about that natural high. You've talked about nature, about food. Can we come back to serotonin? As I said, it's used in an awful lot of medications when treating depression and anxiety. How does it work in the brain?
So, in general, what it does is, I don't know how technical you want me to get, but in essence, our brain sends electrical activity from one neuron to the other, and our neurotransmitters help those messages get passed along. And serotonin is one of the neurotransmitters that helps that happen. So it's extremely essential when it comes to mood regulation, as well as our circadian rhythm, as well as, you know, just feeling a sense of contentment and satisfaction within ourselves. So there have been so many amazing suggestions on how to help that, but I would have to say the three or maybe the four top things that really help all of these neurotransmitters and hormones are good exercise, maintaining a healthy diet, regular sleep. I can't stress this one enough. I mean, the National Sleep Foundation actually recommends 7 to 9 hours, and I would say that is definitely the case, not more than 9 and not less than 7, as well as that relaxation. So practicing deep breathing, because we tend to forget our deep breathing as we go throughout our day. So we breathe a lot more shallow, and we feel, you know, within our stress, we tend to be more activated. So these four things are extremely important in boosting our serotonin levels, but even our dopamine, because although most people know SSRIs to be the serotonin medications that are given, but even there are dopaminergic medications that also work for depression and anxiety. So, and there's even norepinephrine. And so there are many different types of neurotransmitter medications that we use for depression and for anxiety and for other disorders as well. But the idea behind it is having that healthy lifestyle. And I have to stress that, because that healthy lifestyle, not just doing it once or twice in the month, but like literally every single day.
I've had an apple. Why aren't I happy?
Exactly.
I think even that sense of looking after yourself can lead to a sense of well-being. And Rhoda's echoing that on 4001 and talking about your food point as well. Rhoda's saying, when I eat junk food, I immediately feel bad and almost depressed. Healthy organic food really lifts my mood up, partly because my body works great, but also because I'm aware I'm taking care of it. And this can be one of the big kind of red flags for experts such as yourself when it comes to things like diagnosing depression and anxiety, when you don't really care about looking after yourself and looking after your body anymore.
One of the first things that I usually talk about with my clients when they come in and they explain feelings of depression or even anxiety, I ask them about their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And obviously our jump and our first go-to is not, okay, let's put you on medication. But in essence, sometimes you will find people with a healthy, very healthy lifestyle that are still experiencing symptoms of depression and anxiety, and sometimes severely so. So we do acknowledge that there is a biological issue that needs to also be addressed at times, but that's not the case for most individuals.
Interesting question from Gray here saying, are there any supplements I should be taking to be happy? Does vitamin D work? My doctor thinks my low vitamin D levels are why I'm feeling a bit low. There sadly is no silver bullet, it sounds like a combination of these lifestyle factors, you know, the exercise, the diet, the sleep. Mm-hmm. Interesting you mentioned breathing as well, because one of the best-selling books right now is about exactly that, about breath by James Nestor. And I've had numerous experts say to me, both on the show and kind of anecdotally, that at the minute, we don't fully understand the importance of breathing. And, you know, in a decade's time, we'll talk about breathing in the same way we talk about the importance of drinking water and hydration now. And when we spoke in the past about overcoming nerves, you were coming back to breath work as well, about regulating, you know, your body, regulating your emotions through breathing. And it's such a conscious thing. It's such a strange thing to stop and think about, because, you know, we obviously do it all the time to stay alive. But can you explain again some of the things we need to be more mindful of when it comes to taking proper breaths and the impact it has on our body, Thuraya?
Of course. I mean, just to quickly highlight, I mean, we have two parts of our autonomic nervous system, which is our sympathetic nervous system and our parasympathetic nervous system. Now, our sympathetic nervous system is kind of our fight or flight reaction. So this is where our heart rate increases, our pupils dilate. We tend to, you know, breathe very shallow. So this part of our body, when we're activated, when we're feeling stressed, when we're feeling anxious, when we're feeling angry, frustrated, this part of our body is kicking in high gear. And unfortunately, when that part of our body is activated, it's also releasing cortisol and adrenaline. And these are stress hormones. And in order to calm that part of our nervous system down, the breathing is the number one way to activate our parasympathetic nervous system, which is the part of our nervous system that calms our body. It helps our muscles relax. It helps our heart rate slow down. It helps our breathing and our lung capacity to deepen. So the breathing actually helps us go from being activated to not deactivated, obviously, but just not as activated, to pretty much restore our body to homeostasis. And this is such an important thing. So when people talk about breathing, I know it, you know, I get a lot of eye rolling when I tell my clients about breathing. They're like, oh my God, please don't be one of those people that tells me to breathe. And I'm like, well, it's not like that, but it's really about that deep breath. When, and you can feel it, just taking a deep breath in and allowing yourself to exhale for longer than breathing in. You can feel it in your muscles where your body just kind of like turns into putty, you know?
I think
this is very important.
We all need to be a bit more putty right now, I think. So
yes.
Based on all of your research, your reading, clients coming in to your office, if we could all make perhaps just one change in our lives to help our happy hormones do their thing to boost them, is it dark chocolate? Is it early nights? Is it breathing? And I am going to put you on the spot and ask you to just choose one thing that we can all change in a realistic fashion. Maybe even tonight, Thuraya. What would you like to wave your magic wand across the city of Dubai and see a change?
I would like everybody to dance for 5 minutes every day at home.
Oh, well, we can definitely help with that. We've got a great tune coming up. Dr. Thuraya, thank you so much. And I think it's really important to state, it's not about chasing happiness all the time. We want those ups and downs. It's only, you know, I don't want to quote Dolly Parton, but I will. But, you know, you've got rain and rainbows and sunshine. You know, it's not realistic to be happy all the time, but there's certainly some things we can be doing to help our body work in the way it should do. And if you are having any long-term concerns about your mental health, please do get in touch. Dr. Thuraya can be found at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Dr. Thuraya, wishing you a wonderful evening ahead. And as you say,
thank you,
5 minutes of dancing. That's exactly what we've got coming up right now.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.